Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's been such a tough year for so many businesses. So this season, we thought it would be a lovely idea to highlight some of our favorite brands and businesses and use this platform to raise them up. So this week, we are sponsored by and highlighting our favorite kombucha brand, Momo.
I've actually known the founder of Momo for a while as I used to teach him yoga. So it's lovely to be able to share this with you all. If you don't know, kombucha is fermented tea, which when brewed properly is a delicious, slightly fizzy drink that's low in sugar and naturally contains probiotics and healthy organic acids. Momo kombucha is brewed the homemade way in small glass jars and is completely unfiltered. It's also certified organic, meaning it's better for you and the environment.
Momo's newest flavor is the delicious raspberry hibiscus, and they've partnered with the amazing breast cancer charity Future Dreams and are donating 5p to them for every bottle sold. It's also a really great non-alcoholic alternative this festive season. So if you'd like to try Momo for yourself, then they are kindly sharing 15% off using code KITCHEN15. Happy sipping! Hello and welcome back to Kitchen Club with me, Sarah Malcolm, and my wonderful friend, Serena Lauf.
Kitchen Club is the podcast that brings you conversations from our kitchen table. Each week brings a new guest, a new area of expertise, and a new recipe created using our guests' 3 favorite ingredients.
This week's guest is the incredibly knowledgeable Kimberly Wilson. Kimberly is a chartered psychologist, author, and visiting lecturer working in private practice in central London. Her philosophy of whole body mental health is a comprehensive approach to mental health care, integrating evidence-based nutrition and lifestyle factors with psychological therapy.
We loved chatting to Kimberly and just wished that we could have kept going for longer. If you'd like the recipe from this episode, we will be posting it in our brand new Patreon page, which we would love your support on. We'll leave the details in the show notes and would be so happy for you to join our virtual Kitchen Club over there.
Here's Kimberly Wilson on Kitchen Club.
Hello, Kimberly. Welcome to Kitchen Club.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We're so excited to meet you. I just said before we started recording that I feel a bit starstruck because I'm a bit of a Bake Off fan. So very overexcited.
It's just a cake in a tent, honestly.
Just cake in a tent. That's so
Bring
great.
Bring back Mary.
And I just did a dance to Whitney Houston before we recorded. So I felt high on life as well. It's lovely.
Which song?
Wait, hang on. Why has it come to my mind? Don't you want to dance? What's that called?
Dance with somebody, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best one.
I've recently got a Google Nest, so I feel like I just go, hey, Google, play this. And I just get up and dance. So great. Kimberly, let's dive in to your 3 ingredients that you gave us, your favorite 3 ingredients. And we've had quite a challenge with these, but can you remember what you told us?
Yeah.
So, can I say that there was also a bit of a change of plan? So my question is, like, what are my really favorite things? And so one, which sounds odd because I could just say pasta, but specifically pappardelle. I just love the texture of it, like fresh, thick ribbons. I think there's a kind of generosity to it that I really like. It's like the kind of pasta that says, ah, I'm here. it's like unapologetic in its largesse. And then chili. Because I live for chili. There was a period in my life where, like, I almost joked that I would put chili on my cornflakes. It was just, I was on board for chili in everything I could get it in. And there's lots of interesting psychology stuff around chilies in that, you know, people who like chilies, it's not that they or we don't feel the pain. The theory is that we kind of like it.
Sadistic.
And then my original one was pork belly, and I don't eat a huge amount of meat, and so when I do, you know, I want it to be something that feels often something you need to put a lot of time into, like it's more of a kind of ceremony. I think pork belly is one of the kind of cheaper cuts, does that very well. And also it's the kind of thing I have, you know, if I go for like ramen or something, like I know lots of Asian cuisines do it very well, and it's like one of my favorite things. But I had to change that. And so I went for almost equally something that I love, which is kimchi. And again, I do also, it's got chili in, but I eat a lot of fermented foods as well. And I quite like quite punchy, pungent flavors. So fish sauce and chili and garlic all comes together in kimchi with fermentation to make something that's quite sturdy, I suppose.
Sturdy. What a good word for an ingredient.
Large pasta and sturdy kimchi.
I recently saw Jamie Oliver cutting out lasagna sheets, fresh lasagna sheets. So he made them as big as possible. In fact, maybe he just kept them as they were. So they were kind of like these massive sheets of pappardelle instead of, you know, having them their normal size. It looked larger than life. It looked amazing. Serena and I have been sort of toying with how to bring all of your ingredients together, Kimberly, because I Googled kimchi pappardelle or kimchi pasta just to see what would come up. But
oh, really?
We're going to try it out because I sent two different pictures to Serena. I was like, maybe it's a thing. It actually looks really delicious.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, I'm game. I've never heard of it. I've never seen kimchi combined with pasta. A kimchi cheese toastie is a thing of beauty.
My favorite. It's the best. This is a real I think Italians would be quite unhappy to know that we've done this to their carbonara, but we found a lot of recipes for kimchi carbonara, so we're gonna give it a go. And I can't buy kimchi anywhere near my house, so I've got it arriving tomorrow. We're gonna make it for you. And I'm the annoying vegetarian who stopped you having pork belly. So I've ordered some vegetarian bacon so I can make kimchi carbonara and then you can make it with real bacon.
Okay.
Awesome. If it's nice, that is, if it's nice.
And if it's awful, we'll make a new recipe.
So listeners, stay tuned.
I was once in the audience for Ready, Steady, Cook. And it was like totally fascinating because they obviously it's a half hour show, but obviously it's recorded for a couple of hours and there's all the bits and pieces. I mean, don't get me wrong, it is timed and kept to time, but you know, all the kind of faffing at the beginning and warming up the crowd and all of that stuff. And they didn't let you taste the food. And I was like, oh, outrageous. And then it occurred to me, like, if it's only been cooked in 20 minutes, it's probably all raw.
So true. Inedible.
So let's dive in to your areas of expertise. You've had such a varied career. Please pull me up if I have missed anything here, but you've got a nutrition degree. You are governor of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Mental Health Trust.
One of them, yes.
One of them. You led the therapy service at, I never do say HMP Holloway, at Holloway Prison.
Yeah, but I mean, Holloway Prison's fine, yeah.
Which, cool fact, housed loads of the suffragettes.
Yeah.
When housed them, imprisoned them. And before it closed down, it was Europe's largest women's prison.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also former finalist on Great British Bake Off.
All of these are true facts.
Is there anything I've missed?
I think that's enough.
Okay, cool. So there's so much we want to talk to you about. And since it's a foodie podcast, let's start with, did food and nutrition play a big role in your life growing up?
Not in a kind of formal way, you know, lots of people talk about, you know, I grew up, my mum was, you know, on the allotment, bring, you know, that's often a story that people who get into food have. And that wasn't my story. I was just a hungry girl. Like, I was just always just really loved food. But also, my mum inherited from my grandma these big leather-bound red cookbooks. And I think they would have been kind of serialized, like individual sections that you would collect over the years across the like 70s and 80s. But they were enormous. And I remember the smell of them. And I would just spend hours like lying on the floor flicking through, because they'd have full like A4 color images of the dishes. And it was nothing that I was ever going to cook. but there was a kind of a kind of escapism, kind of, it was a kind of a play, like a think about making these dishes and what they would be like and what they would taste like. So that I think was my first interest, literally my own belly and these lovely books. And then when I went to school, I was fortunate enough, and I really mean fortunate because I think it's a life skill and I'm worried that lots of people aren't getting it. I was fortunate enough to go to a school where we had food technology classes and we would do all of the basics. So I don't know if we learned how to fillet a fish, but we, you know, cakes and pastries, learning how to make a basic scondo. And one of the things that always, I think, my mum would always say to me, like, if you've got flour and eggs, you won't go hungry. It's like knowing what to do, the very, very basics. You can make dumplings, you can make breads, you can make scones, you can make stuff stretch. Mm. So I was just kind of into cooking lots and lots and lots, and then became at uni, became the annoying person who was like talking about nutrition and telling friends that you should be drinking green tea, like back in the early 2000s. So it's been a kind of thread in lots of different ways.
That's beautiful. It just struck my mind why we called it food tech.
It used to be called home economics, right?
Yeah.
And it was called food tech, which I think, so this is the story that I've heard, because, you know, part of the, I think at the time, conservative government plan was to help train more people for the food industries and like the industrialization of foods. So one of our whole modules one year was to create a food packaging with the barcode and ingredients and do the nutritional profiling. So it was called food tech, perhaps to bring it up in line with what was called CDT back then, like design technology. But also because it was about food technology and partly about processing and food industry.
Gosh, that's great that your school did that. I think we did it for like half a term once and that was it.
No, I did it for GCSE. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh my God, if I could have done cooking as a GCSE.
Absolutely. It was so much fun. And I did, because you have to design a meal, and I made a sweet pasta dish. So I was like a 15-year-old, a 15-year-old Brit with a pasta roller. I was like, I was such a nerd. but I made a sweet ravioli. So filled with like, I think it was cream cheese and apricots in a raspberry sauce.
Wow, delicious. Innovative. Wow, Kimberly.
It was kimchi pasta.
It's coming up. Podcast near you. So let's dive into your sort of specialist subject, Kimberly, if we were on Mastermind, brain health. Because it says in your very brilliant book, this sort of staggering quote and sentence says, across the lifespan, from the young to the elderly, the leading causes of death and disability are illnesses of the brain and mental health. Which, if you think about it, that's it's just kind of mind-blowing, isn't it? The amount of diseases you think of in the world, and that is the leading cause. And it's something I think that, you know, as a society, taking care of our brain health, you just don't think that. You kind of think of heart health and other sort of areas, but it's so important. So before we sort of dive into everything, what firstly does it mean to have a healthy brain?
Okay. So it can mean different things at different times. And so when I usually think about it, when I think about it for myself as an adult, I think of it as having a brain that you feel you can rely on. It's knowing that if you need to sit down and focus on something for an hour, you will have the attention and the capacity to do that without getting overly fatigued and having to take breaks or having your attention go everywhere. Mm. It's about knowing that you can go to bed and your brain is able to generate good quality sleep. And when you wake, you feel fully rested. It's about being able to go out into the world and not feel overly paranoid, overly anxious, overly, you know, worried that the world is a hostile place, and to be able to engage in good, healthy relationships. And that all comes from having a healthy brain, you know, good mood and focus and attention and all of those things. So as an adult, I think it's about that. I think we also need much more to start thinking about what having a healthy brain means for children. And for children, it's much more about the structural features and components. It literally means making sure children, whether that's in utero or infancy or early childhood, have the right building blocks to make, you know, to start the foundations of a healthy brain in terms of its structure, because that stuff starts even before conception. So a woman's fatty acid profile at conception has an impact on her child's brain development.
Wow.
And we know, for example, that baby boys are much more vulnerable to the mother's fatty acid composition than baby girls are. And then how much essential fat she's getting during her pregnancy will make a difference to the literal size of the baby's brain. So different things at different times, but essentially making sure that you've got the basic healthy structure and that then your brain is also functioning well.
That's fascinating. Gosh,
that is. I didn't know that about, yeah, conception. And then on the flip side of that then, Kimberly, what does sort of symptomatically in the body, what would you say an unhealthy brain would look like? And I know there's a big old list, massive list, but just sort of like pockets of things.
Sure. Yeah. So, an unhealthy brain is a brain that is having to work harder than it already does, I think. So that being, you know, our foundation statement being that the brain is A, the most complex, but B, the hungriest organ in the body. Like, it uses a disproportionate amount of energy in order to just do its normal basic processes. Of the 2000 average calories a day that a body needs, even before doing exercise or moving, around 500 of those calories are just for your brain, right? This little tiny organ is using a quarter nearly of your calories. So your brain has this enormous energy demand. It needs a lot of energy, and it has a big nutrient demand. So not just the nutrients that help to build the structure of the brain, but the nutrients that are needed to make your serotonin, to make your dopamine, to make sure that those signals can fire. And so it needs a good quality supply of all those things just in order to work normally. And so I think an unhealthy brain is a brain that is depleted of those things and therefore is running on fumes. And you're never going to get optimal function out of a brain that's just not, you know, it's like trying to run a car when the energy, when the petrol's basically tanked. But also that your brain relies on the rest of your body for information and other sources of like resources or nourishment. So it needs proper sleep. It needs regular exercise. Your brain is profoundly affected by how much you move or not. So I guess that's broadly a brain, an unhealthy brain is often a neglected brain, but a brain that isn't being given what it needs to function properly. And there are lots of different things that lead into that.
So these days you work in your private practice in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the main things you focus on are the role of food in mental health, disordered eating, the gut-brain axis, which we're going to get into because I'm obsessed, and our emotional relationship with food. So I appreciate that we could literally talk to you for 5 hours, not one. But just to get into it a little bit, how much does what we eat affect our brain health and the way we feel?
Okay. All right. Essentially, really profoundly. So acknowledging that your brain is using up this disproportionate amount of energy and nutrients in from your body. I mean, there are so many ways. So, for example, we know through randomized controlled trials and also large epidemiological studies looking at 11,000 people, 15,000 people, big cohorts, big groups, as well as like mechanisms, like looking at cells in dishes or animal models, that when you, the more a person sticks to their own country's guidelines for what's a healthy diet. So for us, it's the healthy plate or the food triangle, or, you know, whatever. And they're different in every country. But the more you adhere to those guidelines, the less risk of depression you have. And in some of the big meta-analyses, you see what's called a dose response effect, which is the more you adhere, then the better your outcomes. You know, there's a point where it's threshold, but the closer you stick, the less your risk, and the further away you are, the higher your risk of depression. And depression is soon to be our leading cause of disability or disability-adjusted life years, which is the number of healthy years you lose to an illness. And so more people are losing healthy years of like vitality, of joy, of engagement, of productivity, of happy family life to depression than they are to things like cancer, HIV, malaria. Like, depression is a huge psychological burden around the world. And we have this startling finding that if you can improve, and it's starting with people who have poor diets, but if you improve their nutrition, you improve their depression. And that's really important as a psychologist, right? Because depression is, you know, it's one of the two big things that we're trained to work with, depression and anxiety, which often come together. But depression is what you expect to see day in, day out when people are referred to you. And the rates of treatment-resistant depression are going up and up and up and up and up across the world. So we've had effective treatments, you know, antidepressant medication since the 50s and 60s, yet our rates of treatment-resistant depression are going up. More prescriptions are going out, but more people are resistant, are not responding to treatment to 5, 6, 7 different types of medication. So being able to effectively treat depression is a growing kind of urgent need. And no, I'm not saying have a salad and you'll feel better, but understanding the relationship between your nutritional status, your movement, your sleep, and how they might be able to improve the outcomes of something that's causing so many different people distress is really, really important. I feel like I've gone off on a tangent. I feel like I've only answered one part of your question. But
no, that's awesome.
Really important. Nutrition is really important.
And could you tell us a little bit, again, I know it's a massive thing, but a little bit about the gut-brain axis for anybody who's not familiar with the concept?
Sure. And I think lots of people will have heard of it. And there's lots of talk in the press and online about healthy gut and what does it mean to have a healthy gut. And more people are talking about fiber, which is fantastic. But so broadly, the gut-brain axis is the relationship between the gut and the brain. And there are some direct and indirect ways that your brain and your gut talk to each other. So one, and the kind of main structural one, is what's called the vagus nerve, V-A-G-U-S. And it's this beautiful nerve. It sounds strange to describe it like that, but when you see it, it's like, it's such a bird. But, you know, it kind of comes down and it kind of spreads out like these long branches. And it goes down through the back of your throat. It connects in through the heart. It essentially connects through all of your vital organs. So your heart, your lungs, your liver, your spleen, your kidneys. And then finishes up in the gut.
And it's this bi-directional pathway. So messages are going from the top down and from the bottom up. And in fact, more messages coming from the bottom up than from the top down. So, you know, I always say that if you think of it as a motorway with 10 lanes, 7 or 8 of those lanes are going upwards from the body into the brain. So your brain is always gathering this information about what's happening in the body and what's happening in the gut, which is, when you think about it, makes a lot of sense, because your mouth and your gut is where you take in information about the outside world, right? You've got your senses, so you've got sight and touch and smell, which gives you information about the outside world, but only through food do you literally take the outside world into you. And so getting that information up to the brain is really important, and it tells the brain a lot about what's happening around you, or it did in the past, right, in terms of seasonality and risk of famine and all of that sort of stuff. So that's a direct route. The indirect route is really through things like the byproducts of your gut microbiome. So when they eat all of that lovely fiber and they create B vitamins or short chain fatty acids that get into your bloodstream, travel up to the brain, cross into the brain and have effects in the brain that way. And the immune system. So again, because you're taking the world into you from through food is the main way that bacteria and bad things will get into you as well, right? And so it makes sense that a lot of your immune system is in and around the gut to make sure that if you take in like a dodgy bit of meat or whatever, it's there ready to fight back. And so you've got a lot of your immune system in and around the gut, ready to fight anything that's, you know, has arrived that shouldn't be there. And so your gut microbes teach your immune system what's a friend and what's a foe. And so when that works well, you can eat a broad range of things and be fine. When that process doesn't work well, then there can be kind of cases of mistaken identity. You know, allergies are almost a case of this mistaken identity, that your immune system has said, wow, there's a piece of peanut protein, we need to fight it, rather than, but actually it's fine. And then finally, there's this brand new piece of research, which it really makes me just kind of have a bit of awe for the body. But what it showed that was that, so your brain is covered in this membrane. And again, because the brain is so delicate and, you know, really needs to be protected, it's really vulnerable. Your brain has the consistency of jelly or tofu, right? It's really, really vulnerable, but also massively important. It's like, we need to protect it. That's why it's completely encased in a shell, right? Unlike, unlike the rest of your organs, right? It's completely encased. And it has this layer of immune cells as well around it, just to make sure nothing dodgy crosses in from the bloodstream. And some new research has shown that those immune cells that are on the outside of your brain, because your brain has its own immune system inside, it has its own immune response. And the ones that are on the outside were trained in the gut. So they get trained in the gut and then they kind of march around to your brain to protect your brain. I love it.
Gosh. I love that.
Isn't just
the stuff that goes on without us, you know, don't need to think about it.
And I posted the link to that piece of research in my stories. And it just, as I say, like, it makes me have so much awe for the body. And I said to my audience that I just wish we were taught to love our bodies before we were taught to hate them. Yeah. Like, just have the awe and be impressed by all the incredible things that you are doing without even thinking about it.
Yes.
And have this deep appreciation for really how amazing you are.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So our gut and our brain, they're best friends then, essentially.
They really are. For the most part, they get on really well. And I say for the most part, because it depends on what you're feeding it, right? And it depends on, and not just you in terms of your deliberate choices, but of course, as I said, what your mother eats when she's pregnant with you and your early food exposure will have an impact. So we're looking now at the role of the gut microbiome on literally shaping the brain. So that through that vagus nerve, messages get sent up to the brain, which can change the structure of it. And so those early food experiences, or maybe early exposure to antibiotics, which can damage the gut microbiome, might have an impact later on. And we might not, you know, it might just make for a different kind of brain, but it will have an impact on the kind of developmental pathway of the brain. So in a sense, you know, they're both very, they're both hugely important. They're both fairly delicate. The brain, I guess, is a bit more delicate. Your gut is usually a bit more robust, but they're always in constant communication with each other.
And I guess the calmer and the sort of nicer the environment of your gut, the maybe the quieter your brain will be in terms of like calm. And if your gut is happy, then your that relationship will be like, oh, I don't need to, the brain doesn't need to worry about all that stress going on, and it can just like process other stuff and do the thousands of other things it needs to do.
Ideally, but also vice versa though. So one of the reasons that I really, it sounds a bit weird to say, but I really enjoy working with IBS, or at least find it so interesting, is this bi-directional relationship. And one of the things that I see an awful lot most of the time is people who have IBS, and it makes sense that you've got IBS, you think, oh, it's probably the food, it's probably something I've eaten or that I'm sensitive to or I'm allergic to that's giving me these gastro symptoms. But so that vagus nerve, that nerve I mentioned that goes from the top to the bottom, not only is it the main structural component of the gut-brain axis, it is the main component of your parasympathetic nervous system. So your sympathetic nervous system is your fight or flight response, your stress response. It's adrenaline and cortisol and getting ready to fight and, you know, feeling tense and your heartbeat going and your lungs pumping. And the parasympathetic nervous system is the kind of off switch to that. It's the, we call it rest and digest. It's like nice and relaxed. Don't worry. It's okay. It's the state you have to be in to sleep. It's the state you have to be in to have sex. So it's also called the feed and breathe system.
Feed and breathe. I've not heard that. No, that's great.
But essentially, it's this process of being calm and coming back to baseline, to homeostasis. And it's one of the reasons that you should never... And, you know, you shouldn't try to eat when you're stressed, really, or you should try to, if you have to, you should like make it as gentle and digestible as possible. But it's the reason that when you're nervous and anxious, your tummy goes and you get butterflies and maybe you need to have an emergency wee or whatever, right? It's this relationship. And so IBS is a stress sensitive disorder. And for so many people, their IBS symptoms are related to their stress management or the level of stress they're under. They're often they're not aware of how much stress they're under. They hold it, they almost swallow it down, and it finds its expression in their gut symptoms. So, you know, it really goes in both directions. Mm-hmm. And so the calmer the brain is, the better digestion you'll have and the better the gut will work. But also, yeah, the better fed your gut is and your gut microbiome, the more like healthy protective stuff they'll send out to the brain. And the calm, the message of everything is okay is what will be being sent out to the brain.
Yeah. So what should we be eating then, Kimberly, for our brain health? Is something my mum used to talk about loads when I was sort of studying for my levels or whatever. She'd be like, eat a walnut, eat a walnut. So I'd be like, take it in.
So I think your mum was kind of onto something. So walnuts do have omega-3 fats in them, but they... And they are good for the brain and vitamin E, which is also really good for the brain. So walnuts, but mainly if we're thinking about, which is my real soapbox, is omega-3 fatty acids, DHA in particular, and EPA, which are found most abundantly and most bioavailably in marine foods, in oily fish and seafood. And I have growing concern /panic about our population intake of these foods, these fats in particular, you know, with the caveat that there is a sustainability question and, you know, how much can we be taking from the seas and how healthy are the seas? And we might, as we go forwards, need to be thinking about can we synthesize these fats in other ways? But these fats are absolutely crucial to the structure of the brain. We think actually that having ready access to these fats helped us to literally evolve the brains that we have, because human brains are way bigger than they should be. We have the largest brains of any land mammal. Our brains are bigger proportionally than an elephant's brain is.
Wow.
It's and that's kind of cray. Like, our brains are enormous compared to our body size. So for an animal our size, we should have a much smaller brain because the brain uses up so much energy. And so there's always a kind of evolutionary toss up between building a big, strong body and having a big brain, right? Because your brain is using up so much energy. You're like, either you can have a big body and a small brain in terms of how many calories we can get in to sustain you, or you can have a big brain and a small body. So this is what happened. And we believe that it was, you know, that because a huge chunk of human evolution was on the coastlines, and we had ready access to these essential fats, and fish are much less dangerous to catch than, say, a mammoth or whatever it is. You know, they're easier to catch, they're much more abundant, they cook very quickly, all of that sort of stuff. But it was these fats that led to the development of our brains and the complexity of our brains, and that real kind of trajectory, that exponential growth in our brain size compared to our primate relatives. So that's why these fats are so crucial. They literally helped make our brains in the first place.
Wow.
And it means that they continue to be important for us, because evolution doesn't happen that quickly. We still need these fats. The worry is that, according to a paper that was published in 2017, children, less than 4.7% of children are getting the recommended intake of these foods.
Wow.
It's a real problem.
Mm.
And your body can't synthesize DHA. Like, technically it can, but at a rate of about 8%, not enough in order to build a healthy brain, to build a complex, well-connected brain. You see in trials, so in animal studies where they take pregnant mice and feed one group enough omega-3s and the other group not enough DHA, the pups, the babies of those mothers who had deficient DHA, they have smaller brains, smaller hippocampi. The connections in the brain, they're called the dendrites, which are like the points of connection and communication, are smaller, they're stunted, and there are fewer of them. And the signals that the synapses, which is, you know, if I want to very crudely make you happy, I'm going to send a molecule of serotonin across the synapse, that doesn't happen as well. So there are several ways that not getting enough of these fats leaves the brain depleted. So my big, big concern is population level intakes of these fats and how they might be contributing to the rising rates of psychological distress and brain vulnerability that we're seeing, and that had been predicted from the 1970s.
Mm. Off the back of that, do you think that nutrition always plays a role in people's mental health conditions?
Not always, no. I think one of the things about the brain and the body is that we always see them as completely distinct, right? If there's something wrong with your brain, you go and see a psychiatrist or a neurologist and if there's something wrong with your body, you see some other tiny specialist, like a cardiologist for your heart or whatever. And so we've really looked at the body as neck up or neck down for a very long time. And I think what that has done is to completely miss large aspects of where the two are related, like everywhere. but no, the thing, particularly with something like depression, is that it's a very complex, multifaceted disorder. And so one person's depression, as we've seen in some of the trials, might be because they've got a chronically bad, like poor diet, nutritionally depleted diet, and their brain is just like trying to walk uphill in a snowstorm. Their brain is just like, I can't do it. And so for those people, it might be related to some sort of nutritional feature. For other people, it's that they are burnt out from a job that they hate, where they don't have very much control and they don't feel like their work is being recognized or rewarded. For some people, it might be the fact that they had early trauma or adverse experiences in childhood, which lower the threshold for their stress activation. And so they're walking around in this chronic state of stress, and that chronic stress tips them over into depression. So we need to be thinking about, you know, what's causing individual people's depression. My depression is different from your depression, is different from, you know, someone else's depression. And where nutrition might be helpful is in, if we think about the whole body being related in terms of stress or affected in terms of stress, can we take out one of those sources of stress, right? So if for you, the big issue is work burnout, that's what's really driving your depression, like 70% of it. But also because you're burnt out and tired and stressed, when you get home, you just eat 2 chocolate muffins and 3 glasses of wine and go to bed. Actually, that's just turning up your stress. Can we lower the amount of stress that your brain and body is having to deal with by improving your nutrition? And does that buy you a little bit of leverage, right? Does that just make things a little bit easier for you? Does it make it just 2% easier for you then to get through your day? So for me, it's about looking at the body and the brain as a holistic, integrated system, and seeing, because mental health conditions are complex, providing complex solutions, you know, not just, well, we'll give you a pill and fingers crossed that will work, but let's appreciate and honor the fact that this is a complex issue, not treat it in a simplistic way, and look at the ways that we might be able to intervene. And maybe for some people, nutrition is something that's going to give them a little bit of resource or, you know, respite.
It also adds the element of, you know, if when you're thinking about your nutrition and what you're actually thinking, right, what does my body need? What can I sort of take care in? Then it kind of goes down the whole other route of cooking yourself and just taking care of yourself, spending that time, you know, putting in this love, this time for feeding and digesting and the whole rest. Like the cooking part can be the sort of meditative state as well. Yeah.
A kind of reverence. I told one of my clients yesterday, she was describing how rushes eating. And I was like, well, you know, we need to have a little bit of reverence for food, you know, and the people that provide it, you know, that there's, I follow an account on Twitter, which is about farm workers, and it shows you videos of farm workers. And there are people in the driving rain on their knees picking lettuces and cabbages and coriander for us. And for me, whilst, you know, sometimes I have to, I try not to, but, you know, it will happen at some point that I have to quickly eat something. But for me, it's almost about just having respect for the fact that someone is earning their keep on their knees in order for me to be able to pop to the shops and buy some lettuce. And also reverence for the fact that, you know, you're eating something that has grown out of the ground and that, you know, has photosynthesized its way into existence. Like, that's really cool. And I feel like we get so disconnected from our food that we don't see the awe and the reverence in it. And that if we did, A, we'd eat more slowly. Mm. B, that would probably mean that we would digest better and more of the nutrients from our food. We would enjoy it much more. And I think get more pleasure out of it as well, because when it's that whole idea that if you see the effort, or if you put the effort into something yourself, you get more of the reward out of it, right? Like if you've made a, you know, a clay pot, it might be wonky and it might not be professional, but you've made it and you can see the care that went into it. And so you love it in its own way. It's that, you know, the more that we understand and appreciate the effort and care and time that goes into our food production, whether that's in the field, on the farm, in your own kitchen, then the greater appreciation, gratitude that we'll have in the process of eating.
Yeah. So well put. I think it's also so important now when everyone is, well, not everyone, a lot of people are working from home, it can be very easy to fall into, oh, I'll just stay at my laptop and work. Mm. I mean, I guess this kind of goes into a different topic, but, you know, spending all our time at our screen, and being on technology so much, like, that must also kind of question, have the most impact on our brain health and stress, and then bringing that down to eating. This is me, how my brain works, Kimberly. I'm just like, what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think all sorts of things. I think that, yeah, I talked to a dermatologist friend of mine, and she's saying that there's been a rise in people wanting fillers and Botox because they're sat at their screens on calls like this, looking at their own faces. And it's just an unnatural thing to do. So you just spend your whole time like looking at your face and over fixating on it and thinking, oh, maybe there's something, you know, and being really aware that someone else is looking back at you. That's not the normal thing that happens in conversation in the real world. You know, we're sat down and I'd just be looking at your face and paying attention, hopefully, and being interested in you and all of that stuff. And instead, there's this really strange way in which I'm talking, but I'm also really aware of what I'm doing, what I'm saying, what my face is doing, and it becomes partial performance. And when our interactions become partial performance, then we end up kind of objectifying ourselves much more. We start looking at ourselves as objects rather than being kind of present and subjective.
That's really interesting.
I think the same thing happens with food. I think food on Instagram does the same thing. And I post food on Instagram, so I don't know whether I'm playing into this or whether, you know, sometimes I'm subversive and I will just post beans on toast, because let's not pretend that we don't eat beans on toast. Why are we eating
like best meal
avocado toast? No, we eat beans on toast and get with it. But the food, well, I mean, this is a separate part, but the way that food is used symbolically and to represent things, food, certainly in the UK, is a massive indicator of class, either class affiliation or class aspiration. And there's a way in which the food just becomes, again, an object, a visual thing. I posted the story a long time ago now about, and with just shock and horror, that their restaurant owners were saying that we have groups of bloggers coming in, ordering table loads of food, taking pictures, and then leaving.
And not eating it. Oh my God, that makes me so angry.
Oh. And that's where the respect is lost completely, isn't it?
I mean, right, where you complete, where, so when we spend so much time, when we're viewing, whether it's ourselves or our food through a screen, it becomes an object, it becomes disconnected to meaning and value. And so you think nothing of the fact that there's a chef in the kitchen who's been slaving away for hours to produce these meals, and you're just going to consume them in order to get likes. And, you know, it's a whole thing.
Oh my goodness. Gosh. That's so mad, isn't it? And I always say this, but I think the reason we started this podcast, I mean, ordinarily we would all be eating our kimchi pappardelle together, but it's to have that appreciation of the ingredients that light us up, and yeah, the respect for our food
and the way food brings people together and enjoying it together.
Yeah.
Hugely important. Food does bring us together. It always has. The idea of a campfire, and the fact, well, essentially food drove evolution is my hypothesis. Because you have to cooperate in order to hunt. You have to come together in order to produce a meal, to set up the fire, to find the food, to gather the berries, to pick the, you know, whatever. You have to keep each other safe. And so food is a huge part of the development of cooperation in the human species.
What a nice little
talk about your healthy habit then, so Sarah can go and teach.
Sure.
I've got a million questions.
I know. I'm sorry. Sorry, students, not coming.
Can you tell us, Kimberly, what your healthy habit was, please?
Yes, my healthy habit is, well, in normal times, a half hour sauna, but in corona times, a hot bath. And that for me is just the ultimate way to relax. And there's what's nice for the other part of me, the nerd part, the science part, is that there's lots of really growing evidence about the importance of heat exposure or the effect of heat exposure on reducing your risk of Alzheimer's disease. So that's a nice bonus.
Wow, that is a big bonus. Is that, can we find more info on that somewhere?
In the book.
There we go, in the book.
I've done a whole chapter on heat exposure and how it works and like how these amazing little proteins are like coming together to help protect your brain.
Wow. So listeners, let's read the book in the bath.
Yes.
Yes. Heaven.
And I mean, I don't have a bath, which is sad. But weirdly, this morning, Kimberly, I've had no hot water. We've had no hot water for like a month. And this morning, we had hot water and it was like, you know, super hot. And it was so lovely. And I thought, is this because we're talking to Kimberly today? And I just like, you know, soaked in the steam. And it was lovely.
So good.
Yeah, thank you.
Hot water.
Kimberly sent you hot water.
Yeah, I love that. Try and curb my narcissism here.
I think a hot bath is the best cure for anything.
So it's just the most relaxing thing. Yeah, I love it. And you know, there's a reason that lots of different cultures around the world, whether we're talking kind of sweat lodges or, you know, Scandinavian sauna or, you know, Russian baths, that there's a reason that this exposure to hot, to heat or to hot water has been persistently applied in cultures around the world. And now we're seeing the science behind it, that it does improve mood. It seems to protect against depression and it seems to be able to help reduce your risk of dementia. So lots of very good side effects.
Yeah. So this chat is just a lovely little taste into Kimberly's fantastic book that we can all just enjoy and learn so much more. But thank you so much for joining us, Kimberly.
I'm sorry we didn't have longer. I've got literally 20 more questions in my head for you. You're so wise. I think it's because I've got a geek in me too. So the geek in me loves the geek in you.
Sitting at the front of the class like, hello. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much, Kimberly. What a woman. And we just want to say, since recording that episode with Kimberly, Serena has now made this wild old kimchi recipe. So, Serena, tell us, how was it?
It was an experience. And actually, it was bloody delicious. But it's bizarre. It's like, it kind of is just like a delicious, spicy, creamy, cheesy pasta. So no complaints. Pappardelle is a great pasta. I fully agree with Kimberly. Mm. And the veggie bacon is a weird one. I've not tried it before. And it actually lends itself really nicely to the recipe because it means you get these little like crunchy, salty, smoky bits inside. But I guess if you are not into that, or if you eat meat, you could just use some normal bacon.
The picture looks absolutely delicious.
Thanks, honey.
I'm going to make it ASAP Rocky. If you'd like that recipe, which will be delicious, otherwise we wouldn't be telling you about it for today's episode, you can find it on our Patreon page, which we'll leave in the show notes below this episode. And it's really lovely to have your support over there. We're growing a little community and it's just gorgeous. We'll also leave Kimberly's details all below this episode so you can find out more about her.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.